Hello, pals. It's me, Duncan, and you're listening to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast, and I'm recording this intro from the Open Your Heart in Paradise retreat in Maui. And I've been sitting in my hotel room trying to record an intro for the last, 3 hours. And everything that's coming out is ridiculous and weird. I've been laying on the floor talking about unconditional love and saints and the transmission of divine truth through the body vehicles of enlightened beings. I sound like a sun-addled kombucha dealer wandering the deserts of Burning Man, so I'm not going to record an intro for this podcast until I fully assimilated the information that I'm getting here at this amazing meditation retreat, which means we're going to dive right into it after some very quick business. This episode of the DTFH is brought to you by WearSpace.com. That's WearSpace.com. This is Aubrey Marcus's new t-shirt company, and the idea for Space is to have truly fashionable t-shirts that serve a purpose. These are really cool shirts. They aren't covered with meaningless graphics, but they have awesome designs that help generate awareness and also generate revenue for charities. Each of the shirts has been imprinted with a design that represents various plant medicines as well as MDMA, and a minimum of 5% of all proceeds for every shirt sale go towards a charity related to the content on the shirt. The premium line has a custom story printed on the inside, and it has all been made in Italy. So they're fashionable, fancy, badass shirts, and if they're a little out of your budget, they also have an Austin Fit line, which is a little more affordable, printed in Austin, and starts at $28.50. You can check them out by going to www.wearspace.com. This is a great way for you to buy some really cool t-shirts for yourself or your friends for Christmas while supporting some really cool charities and some great organizations like Reset.me, as well as the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. I hope you will at least go to the website and check them out. I think you're really going to like them. And thank you very much, Aubrey, for sponsoring this episode of the DTFH. We're also brought to you by Amazon.com. If you're doing any kind of Christmas shopping, why not go through our portal located in the comments section of any of these podcasts? Just click on that portal, and anything that you buy through Amazon, they will give us a very small percentage of, and it costs you nothing. So not only do you get your delicious bits of wonderful, sweet-smelling plastic, you also get to support your favorite podcast. We've got a lot of great t-shirts, stickers, and posters located at DuncanTrussell.com. Some new designs are coming in soon. I hope you'll check out our shop, and I hope you'll forgive me for this very brief intro. My brain is scrambled from all of these amazing, super spiritual hippies that I've come into contact with, and I really can't do a regular intro for this podcast while the sweet waves of Maui are crashing outside of my hotel room, and I'm assimilating the information download that I've been getting from Ram Dass and Sharon Salzberg. So I'm just going to introduce today's guest. He is a really brilliant author. He wrote an incredible book called Fingerprints of the Gods. Most recently, he's written another fantastic book called Magicians of the Gods. I just finished reading it. It's exhilarating and scary and just a really fun book to read. He is a genius. He's somebody who makes me a little nervous to be around, so I hope you will forgive me if I seem a little nervous or stammery while interviewing him. But come on, he's a modern-day Indiana Jones who has a really incredible perspective on the world that we're living in. So now, everybody, please open your heart and your soul to the incredible Graham Hancock. Graham Hancock, welcome back to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. Thank you so much for being on the show again.
Duncan, it's my absolute pleasure to be with you again. I always enjoy our chats.
I have been so enjoying your new book, Magicians of the Gods. It is just fantastic, incredible writing. Thank you so much for sending it to me. It's just been a blast reading it, and I've got a ton of questions for you.
Right.
I thought I'd start off by asking if you could talk a little bit about what happened to the giant beaver?
Good opening question. The giant beaver, the mind, the imagination dilates at the concept of the giant beaver. Yes, the giant beaver was one of a number of what are called megafauna or mega mammals that lived in the United States prior to 12,800 years ago, and that was rendered extinct in a global extinction-level event that unfolded between 12,800 and 11,600 years ago. Becoming extinct alongside the giant beaver, I almost said going down with the giant beaver, were the other megafauna, like, for example, the woolly mammoths, the woolly rhinos and the mammoths, and in South America, the mastodons. These creatures were wiped out in a single geologic incident, an extinction-level event. The epicenter was in North America, but it was a global event, a deeply mysterious event that geologists refer to as the Younger Dryas.
And in your book, you talk about how this event is possibly caused, or now it's becoming more and more accepted that this event was caused by a comet flying through Earth's atmosphere and superheating the ice caps.
Well, a bit more complicated than that. First of all, it's way beyond speculation now. This has been largely confined to the rarefied air of extremely specialized scientific journals since the first evidence began to be published in 2007. And the general public are not fully aware of what's been going on behind the scenes. So one of the things I've done in four chapters of Magicians of the Gods is to summarize this new scientific evidence and to present it in hopefully a readable manner that is accessible to everyone. The evidence is this, I'll take it back a little further. The evidence really goes back 20,000 years. That's when calculations indicate that a giant comet with a diameter of at least 100 kilometers and possibly as much as 200 kilometers was drawn in to the inner solar system. Comets themselves are very interesting and mysterious things. There's a source of comets that astronomers refer to as the Oort cloud, which exists a vast distance from the sun and the earth and is a kind of sphere that surrounds the whole solar system. And this cometary source is calculated to contain trillions of comets, thousands and thousands of millions of comets, many of them of very large size. Now, another thing that most people aren't aware of is that our sun and the Earth with it, the whole solar system, is in orbit around the center of our galaxy. Our galaxy is the Milky Way, and it has a huge black hole at the center of the galaxy. And we are in orbit around that, and it's a very huge orbit that unfolds over hundreds of millions of years. But as the solar system orbits around the center of the galaxy, it doesn't just orbit in the plane of the galaxy. It dives up and down through the plane of the galaxy in a kind of undulating motion, a bit like a dolphin surfacing above the surface of the sea and then dropping below and then rising up again. And we cross the galactic plane approximately every 30 million years. When we cross the galactic plane, gravitational disturbances are unleashed in the Oort cloud and in the other source of comets, which is called the Kuiper Belt. And this destabilizes the orbits of comets in these two areas. And comets are then sent winging their way in towards the inner solar system, a journey that can take a very, very, very long time indeed. The evidence is that 20,000 years ago, roughly, one of these giant comets entered the inner solar system and was captured by the sun and went into an orbit around the sun, an orbit that crosses the path of the Earth.
And this is Comet Encke? Is this the...
Well, Comet Encke is actually a fragment of the original giant comet. It's still there. In fact, there are several large bits of the original giant comet that are still in orbit around the sun and still crossing the orbit of the Earth twice a year. And Comet Encke is one of those. But to take the story on, what happened 12,800 years ago was that several fragments of this comet, remember that comets are huge chunks of rock bound together by ice.
Right.
And they have a tendency to break up into multiple fragments. We saw this happening with Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 when it hit Jupiter in 1994. That was quite a small comet, just 2 kilometers in diameter. But it broke up into 20 fragments, and those fragments colorfully and spectacularly and ballistically bombarded Jupiter in 1994. By the way, the explosive power of any one of those 20 impacts would have exceeded the power of the entire nuclear arsenal of the Earth going off at once. This is what comets do. The comet we're dealing with now is a much bigger comet than the one that hit Jupiter in 1994. We're dealing with a comet at least 100 kilometers in diameter, enters the inner solar system 20,000 years ago, and begins to break up into fragments as comets do. And these fragments spread out along the orbit of the comet so that the orbit becomes a trail of debris with some very large bits and some much smaller bits in it. And it becomes very wide. This trail of debris still exists today, and it's 30 million kilometers wide, and it takes the Earth 12 days to pass through it because the Earth travels at the rate of 2.5 million kilometers a day on its orbital path. Anyway, to get to the point, to cut to the chase, as they say, 12,800 years ago, several fragments of this comet crossed the path of the Earth directly and entered the Earth's atmosphere and hit the Earth. We're looking at 4 or 5 objects, each of them in the range of a half a mile to a mile in diameter, that come in at about 70,000 miles an hour, and they hit the Earth. And the primary impacts at that time were on the North American ice cap. This was the Ice Age. And although it was the Ice Age had been warming up gradually for the previous 8,000 years or so, the ice caps were still about 2 miles deep over North America. It's hard to imagine this mountain height of ice covering all of North America, north of, shall we say, Minneapolis.
Wow.
The comet fragments come in, and remember, they're only part of the whole comet. The rest of it's still in orbit in that 30 million mile wide stream, debris stream. Several fragments enter the Earth's atmosphere and they collide with the North American ice cap, unleashing a horrendous global cataclysm, which geologists refer to as the Younger Dryas. Instantly, there's evidence of massive worldwide flooding, and instantly, global temperatures plunge. The world has been warming up. Now, suddenly, 12,800 years ago, it gets extremely cold, colder than it was at the peak of the last ice age. And this moment, 12,800 years ago, the evidence now is that we're not looking at something that happened over a few days or a few weeks. We're looking at something that happened in a single afternoon. And it affected 50 million square kilometers of the Earth's surface, a gigantic area. North America was the epicenter of the disaster. Further fragments of the comet crossed the Atlantic Ocean and hit the northern European ice cap. And the last rainout of fragments occurred as far east as Syria. The evidence for this is absolutely compelling. And it unleashed a global cataclysm, and it led to the extinction, amongst others, of our friend, the giant beaver.
Okay? What a sad day.
And sea levels rise, and the world gets incredibly cold. And this cold period lasts for 1,200 years until 11,600 years ago, when, lo and behold, the Earth crosses the path of other fragments of the same horrible comet. And those other fragments plunge into ocean, and they create tidal waves. A huge rise in sea levels is accompanied with this. A massive cloud of water vapor is thrown up into the upper atmosphere, enshrouds the Earth entirely for a period of at least 100 years, and causes intense global warming, way beyond anything that anybody who talks about global warming today could even imagine. Intense global warming. The global temperature shoots up. There's evidence of enormous flooding 11,600 years ago, and that's the end of the Younger Dryas period. And here's the thing. The evidence for this global cataclysm, a series of cataclysms, a cataclysmic episode lasting 1,200 years, is so fresh, it's so new, and it's been so much confined to the scientific journals, that archaeologists and historians have not yet had time to build it into their model of the origins of civilization. So right now, what is being taught in our schools and our universities is a model of the origins of civilization that does not take account of a global extinction-level event that occurred right in the foundations of that model of history. And therefore, we have to begin to ask ourselves, is it possible that everything we've been taught about the origins of civilization could be wrong? Is it possible that this global cataclysm swept away an advanced civilization of prehistory along with those megafauna that were made extinct, an advanced civilization of prehistory that now is only remembered in myths and traditions?
And this is an idea that is apparently really controversial, and there's a lot of people who subscribe to a different notion of the way the earth changes. And I can't recall the word from your book, but it's the idea that things on earth just change over time. What was the name for that? Do you remember?
It's called uniformitarianism.
Right, and uniformitarianism.
It's a dogma of geology, but we need to understand the origins of that dogma. There's a reason for it. But back in the Middle Ages, the world was a very superstitious place. Everything was seen to be the result of the action of supernatural agencies and of gods and demons and things like that, God in particular. And the flood of Noah is one of the stories that's told in the Bible. And at that time, you know, it was believed literally by many people, and it was taken as how things were. And what happened in what's referred to as the Enlightenment, really from the 1600s onwards, once it became clear, for example, that the Earth revolves around the sun rather than the other way around, there was a reaction in science against the old superstitious ideas. And any cataclysmic agent was lumped together with those old superstitious ideas as being of no more significance than the story of the flood of Noah, which, of course, the new scientists completely rejected. And they found themselves, in order to define themselves in opposition to religious superstition, they proposed another model, which is, yes, the earth is very old and the earth changes very, very slowly, and events and processes and procedures as we can see them today, geological processes on the earth as they unfold today, are a good guide to how things were in the past. And since we see no cataclysm on a global scale unfolding today, the dogma of uniformitarianism is that such things could not have happened in the past.
Right.
The opposite point of view is catastrophism, that global catastrophes have played a key role in the story of the Earth, in the story of life on Earth, and in the human story. But those catastrophist ideas are still in the minds of mainstream scientists tainted by the old superstitions in which catastrophes were seen as the work of God. And I think it's time science got over this, because it's absolutely evident that cataclysms have played a key role in the story of life on Earth.
And that's one of the stunning parts of your book, is the way that you bring together all of these different myths that all say exactly the same thing, to the point where it invokes a kind of empathy for these humans living during this time period. It's really is kind of heart-wrenching to imagine whatever the planet was like before this happened, and suddenly everything changing in an instant. And you do a really good job. I never expected to feel empathy for people living over 10,000 years ago, but I started feeling really sad for humans walking on this planet that from time to time just instantaneously changes. And I think that's one of the really exciting aspects of your book, is because it points out just how fragile life is when you're floating in the middle of a void filled with deadly flying, massive flying objects in space.
Yes. A very hazardous cosmic environment, in fact, is what we occupy, which is not a reason for gloom and doom. We're probably the first civilization on this planet that has the technology, if we choose to exercise it. We have the technology to make our cosmic environment safe. But right now, we're too busy killing one another with weapons of mass destruction and investing vast amounts of money in warfare and hatred and fear and suspicion, and we've rather taken our eye off the ball of the hazards of the cosmic environment. Yes, these earth-changing events, it's important to be clear how radical they are. And the odd thing is, you know, that science has accepted that some of them happen, but somehow is finding it very difficult to apply to the time frame of human history. So, for example, we know that the dinosaurs were made extinct 65 million years ago by a cosmic impact.
Right.
An object about 6 miles wide that came in at enormous speeds, hit the Gulf of Mexico and the edge of the Yucatan Peninsula, created a global firestorm and a massive, massive change of climate and huge earthquakes and volcanic eruptions all over the Earth as the crust of the Earth is destabilized by these impacts. And the net effect was that the dinosaurs became extinct 65 million years ago, or at least devolved. You know, dinosaurs were turned into chickens by this event.
Right.
That's kind of it's that big. It changes things that much. At the same time, a little shrew-like creature that was skulking miserably around in the primeval forests, an early representation of the mammal family, which was going nowhere while the dinosaurs ruled the Earth. Once the dinosaurs had been swept out of the way, that little shrew-like mammal was able to begin the process of evolution. And 65 million years later, here we are. The end result of that.
Right.
That was our 65 million year old grandmother that was liberated by the extinctions of the dinosaurs and able to embark on a path of evolution that eventually led to the human race.
Incredible.
So these are world changing events. When an extinction level cataclysm occurs, it utterly changes the world. I say jokingly, you know, but it kind of sums it up, to turn dinosaurs into chickens and shrews into human beings. It's hard to imagine. You know, a bigger change than that. And nobody disputes that happened. The problem is that, again, for the reasons of uniformitarian dogma, a number of scientists at any rate, are finding it very difficult to accept the new evidence that an extinction-level event on exactly that scale unfolded 12,800 years ago.
It's so odd that we can accept that the dinosaurs were wiped out by an impact, but for some reason when it comes to something happening closer to us, it really is odd to me that this is something that anyone would be skeptical about. It just seems to make sense.
Yeah, it makes complete sense. But if we go back and actually look at the science on the dinosaurs, it's important to realize that when Lewis and Walter Alvarez first put forward the proposition that the dinosaurs had been made extinct by a cosmic impact, they were effectively intellectually exiled by their colleagues. They were driven into the outer darkness. Nobody would speak to them because they were daring to propose a cataclysmic mechanism which contradicted the dogmas of uniformitarianism. And it took them 10 years to get the evidence accepted. I mean, the evidence was overwhelming. There is a distinct stratum in the Earth from 65 million years ago, which includes a vast layer of ash and soot. And that vast layer of ash and soot was produced by continent-wide wildfires. And in that same layer, those wildfires being caused by the superheated ejecta coming out of the impact site and falling hundreds of miles away from the site of the impact. And at the same time, in that same layer, which is called the Cretaceous Tertiary Boundary, we're found other chemical and physical products which can only be caused by the impact of a very large rock from outer space. And those include iridium, massive quantities of iridium in the soil. They include melt glass, which is exactly like the trinitite that was created in nuclear blasts. They include nanodiamonds visible only under the microscope, which are created, literally created, by the shock and heat of the impact, carbon spherules, and evidence for temperatures in excess of 2,200 degrees centigrade, which actually is the boiling point of quartz, across a huge area of the Earth's surface all at once. These impact proxies on their own should have been enough to convince science that a cataclysm had occurred 65 million years ago, but the dogma of uniformitarianism caused this to be resisted for a decade until the Alvarez team were able to produce the crater. And they did eventually produce the crater. And as I mentioned, it's in the Gulf Gulf of Mexico, partly overlapping the present Yucatan Peninsula. And when that crater emerged and was securely dated to 65 million years ago, exactly the moment of the extinction of the dinosaurs, that's when the uniformitarian arguments went away and it was accepted that the extinction of the dinosaurs was caused by a cosmic impact. Well, we're in the same process now with the Younger Dryas boundary. Just as that was the Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary, we have another layer in the soil called the Younger Dryas boundary, which dates to 12,800 years ago. And lo and behold, we see all the same impact proxies in it, exactly the same as occurred with the 65 million year ago incident. We see that big layer of ash and soot in the soil caused by global wildfires. We see the nanodiamonds, we see the melt glass, we see the evidence for stunningly high temperatures, the carbon spherules, and so on and so forth. And again, it's like deja vu, it's like Groundhog Day. Again, science is resisting this and demanding to see the crater. Well, the good news is for the team, that the team of more than 30 top scientists, highly credentialed mainstream scientists who've been advancing the evidence for the Younger Dryas impact, the good news for them is that craters are now being found. And those craters lie on the northeast of North America, beyond the edge of the former ice cap. The reason that craters have been harder to find up to now is because the primary impacts were on the North American ice cap, which, as I said, was 2 miles deep. And so the craters themselves, most of them, were excavated in ice. They caused the liquidization of that ice, unleashing a flood of icy meltwater. And then, of course, the craters were transient. They vanished. They disappeared, leaving only shock effects on the ground, which also can now be traced. The evidence has gone far beyond the impact proxies. We are now dealing with crater evidence for this event 12,800 years ago. And the tide is turning. The uniformitarian dogmatists no longer have a leg to stand on. And more scientists are coming around to accept, yes, this is absolutely what happened. But it's good that it's been subjected to the fire of scientific criticism, because it means this new idea is a very solid one. It's withstood all attempts to refute it, and it stands strong today. And the latest paper was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences just a couple of months ago, as a matter of fact. The evidence keeps coming in.
So here we have existing on planet Earth, not just giant beavers, not just the American cave lion, yeah, but possibly an advanced civilization that were up until this point, we haven't really, it's something that's considered to be myth, this concept, yeah, that there existed on planet Earth over 12,000 years ago. There was some group of people that had some technology that we don't understand exactly, but that they're spoken of in myth.
Yes, that's right. That is the suggestion that I actually first made in Fingerprints of the Gods back in 1995. I mean, it's interesting to see what's happened there, because when I published Fingerprints of the Gods in 1995, I didn't have the science that I have today. The scientific discovery of the comet impacts was years ahead in 1995. That discovery would not begin to be published until 2007. But all the evidence suggested to me that there had been a global cataclysm exactly in that window between 12,800 and 11,600 years ago. And I proposed that in Fingerprints of the Gods. I put those dates, particularly 12,500 years ago was the sort of central date that I focused on, 10,500 BC. And at the time, of course, I was massively criticized for suggesting that there'd been a global cataclysm then. I looked at a number of possibilities of what might have caused that cataclysm, most notably amongst them the Earth crust displacement idea of Professor Charles Hapgood that was further refined by and the Rose Flemath. But I didn't have the science to back up what I was saying. And so, in a sense, that book was an easy target for scientific criticism. And I was suggesting in that book that there had been an advanced civilization that was destroyed in that cataclysm. And again, that was based on my interpretation of lots and lots of evidence around the world. And all of those interpretations, I believe, still hold today. But at the time, it was much easier for mainstream archaeology to dismiss it. Since then, we have the evidence for the cataclysm. And it's not evidence that's being produced by the alternative or alternative historians or by fringe science. This is evidence that's being produced by, you just couldn't get more mainstream science than this. It's absolutely compelling.
But still, it seems like there's a lot of people who are viciously fighting against the concept that these civilizations existed. And yes. I really was amazed at the amount of resistance that you received in some of these places. Like, you were almost attacked. Did I read it wrong that you were almost attacked in Gunung Padang? Did I say that right?
Gunung Padang in Indonesia. No, I wasn't attacked in Gunung.
But the villagers there have assaulted. They've assaulted people who are.
Oh yes, the team who are doing the excavation at Gunung Padang have indeed been assaulted.
Right. Okay. That's where I got confused.
And those assaults have been stirred up by archaeologists who want to stop the excavations there.
Can you talk a little bit about
excavating this man-made pyramid that's more than 20,000 years old in Indonesia called Gunung Padang? Are geologists and archaeologists deeply resent. That it's geologists who are exposing this site, and actually archaeologists have tried to stop, and indeed they have stopped the excavations. The excavations are on hold at the moment because of archaeological objections. But these excavations are being headed by PhD Danny Hilman Natwijaja, who's Indonesia's leading geological expert in megathrust earthquakes, and who has his PhD from Caltech, and who is an enormously experienced man. He's very interested in archaeology. And when he went to this, what was a known megalithic site in Indonesia that was thought to be 2,500 years old, standing on top of what was thought to be a natural hill, his geological antennae started to perk up. And he looked at that so-called natural hill and felt very strongly that it was not a natural hill, but that it was a man-made hill. And he assembled a team of geological experts who came in with the latest equipment, the ground-penetrating radar, the electrical resistivity, the seismic tomography, and they were able to run lines of sensors all over this so-called man-made hill and to show what's in its interior structure. And actually, it's an entirely man-made structure. And the carbon dates that have been brought up from the depths of it are absolutely stunning. They go back more than 20,000 years. Datable organic material in direct association with stones that have been worked by human beings, 20,000 years old. This alone completely rewrites history. 20,000 years ago, in the depths of the Ice Age, we're not supposed to have had any ability to create structures like this.
Unfortunately,
the reaction of archaeology has been to this new evidence, which one would have thought they'd be very excited about and want to get in on. The reaction of archaeology has been to stop it, to do everything they can to stop it.
Well, they say it's volcanic activity, right? That's the argument. The argument is that you're actually the dating that you're doing is you're measuring just, I guess, lava tubes down there. Is that?
Well, this comes from the ignorance of the archaeologists in question. The megalithic site itself that sits on top of this man-made hill is the material is called columnar basalt, which is the result of volcanic activity. And columnar basalt does form into naturally blocky forms.
Right.
As a matter of fact, the Giant's Causeway in Ireland is a famous natural site made of columnar basalt. The thing about columnar basalt is that when it forms naturally, it forms in vertical formations. The moment you find it laid out in horizontal formations and actually used as an obvious building material, you can set aside the natural explanations. Human beings have been here, they've taken the material that was provided by nature, as all stone is, and they've worked it and assembled it together into a man-made site. And that's what we're looking at Gunung Padang, absolutely no doubt about it. And the carbon dating has come from organic material that's been brought up in drill cores. They've drilled down into the heart of this structure, down to a depth of 300 feet from the top. And they have pulled up very distinctly associated worked stones, which have been cut and shaped by man, associated with datable material, because you can't date the stones themselves, associated with datable material going back as much as 20,000 years. Now, what's needed next is a thorough, full-scale excavation of the entire site. But that's not happening because archaeologists have stopped it. It was stopped in 2013. Then it got restarted because Dani took the case to the then president of Indonesia, who agreed that the excavation was worthy and should continue, and in fact provided a budget. But then it was stopped again in 2014 when the presidency changed. A new president came in. He listened to the objections of archaeologists. And right now, at the crucial moment, actually, just as they were about to get into one of the three very large regular chambers that have been identified inside this structure, the excavations were stopped again. And they're still on hold as we speak now on the 25th of November, 2015. I'm optimistic that the excavations will restart. Dani is lobbying at the highest level. He's very effective at that. And I think we will see the excavations restarting quite soon. And then the truth of Gunung Padang finally will come out.
And what do you think that truth is going to be?
I think that truth is going to be a hall of records, an archive of a lost civilization. And I say that for very specific reasons. Firstly, because there are three artificial chambers inside this pyramidal mound, absolutely regular and identified by the ground-penetrating radar and the electrical resistivity. And secondly, because of the background of Indonesia itself. You see, Indonesia today, if we look at Southeast Asia, we see the Malaysian Peninsula, and then we see the Indonesian islands of Indonesia consists of a number of large islands and a number of small islands. We see these islands below the Malaysian Peninsula. That's not how this landmass looked during the Ice Age, when sea level was 400 feet lower than it is today. Right. This was a huge continent-sized landmass, a continuous landmass extending down from the area that's roughly Cambodia right down into the depths of the Indonesian islands. All joined together as one vast landmass. And then between exactly those same dates, 12,800 to 11,600 years ago, there's this cataclysmic rise in sea level, and that landmass is swallowed by the sea, and the Malaysian Peninsula is what's left, and the islands of Indonesia are what's left. And it's on the high land of one of those Indonesian islands, remnant islands, the island of Java, that Gunung Padang has been found. And it appears to be the result of a deliberate choice of site. A site that would always be safe from sea level rise was chosen, and this place was put there. And something else, the name Gunung Padang is often mistranslated. People think it's in the Indonesian language. And in the Indonesian language, Gunung Padang means mountain field, which doesn't sound very exciting. But actually, the language that's spoken around Gunung Padang is not Indonesian. The language that's spoken in that area is Sundanese. And in the Sundanese language, Gunung Padang means mountain of enlightenment. Hmm. And there is an ancient tradition associated with this pyramid. That links it to wisdom keepers and to advanced knowledge from the past, and that regards it as a sacred place. And this, I think, should be the hint that we're dealing with something very special here, something that is being revealed by the new investigations.
And that's very exciting. That's very exciting, because your theory is that pyramids are actually storehouses for this information. Is that right?
Yes, I think it's the case with the Giza pyramids as well.
And they just found. You must be excited because.
Yeah. Well, when you use the word storehouse, I want to separate myself far away from any notion that the pyramids were used as storehouses for grain. God forbid! You would have to be a lunatic to build a 6 million ton monument with a 13-acre footprint.
Here's what's interesting about that, yeah, is that when you think about it, it's kind of a similar thing in the sense that grain is something that feeds people. It's, yeah, almost as though they're onto something. The people who believe that are kind of onto something in a weird way.
Oh, yes. But I think we have to listen to the ancient traditions about what the pyramids are. And there is an ancient tradition, not that they were stored. Houses for grain. I mean, we have to. I agree with you that the concept is of a storage of something of value to, yes, mankind, yes, is interesting. But you know, frankly, a grain silo needs to have a large hollow space in which to store the,
sure,
grain.
It's a ridiculous idea.
it's a crazy idea, but the ancient traditions that surround the Great Pyramid do say that it was a storehouse of knowledge, and that that knowledge came from before the flood. And they do say that the pyramids were built so big and so strong that they would preserve that knowledge effectively for forever. As the Arabs say, you know, time itself fears the pyramids. And these traditions are fascinating. And they speak of ancient high technologies being hidden within the pyramids, metals that did not rust, glass that did not bend, glass that bent, which sounds a lot like plastic.
Yes.
Many traditions of this, idols which could move and which spoke. They sound almost like robots. There are distinct traditions about the Great Pyramid suggesting this and suggesting that it encapsulates all the knowledge of a former civilization that was destroyed in the Great Flood. And we now know that there was indeed cataclysmic flooding between 12,800 and 11,600 years ago. And here's a number of ways that the Great Pyramid is a storehouse of knowledge, even setting aside the issue of hidden chambers within the Great Pyramid. I'm very certain that there are undiscovered chambers in the Great Pyramid, and a recent thermal imaging survey has indicated that very strongly that that is the case, that the chambers so far found are only part of the story and that more waits to be revealed. But setting aside the issue of what may be concealed in those hidden chambers, all we have to do is take the dimensions of the Great Pyramid. If you measure the base circumference of the Great Pyramid and multiply it by 43,200, you get the equatorial circumference of the Earth. And if you measure the height of the Great Pyramid and multiply it by the same number, 43,200, you get the polar radius of the Earth. So in all those centuries and aeons when, you know, we went through the Dark Ages and we didn't even know we lived on a planet, let alone that it was spherical, let alone what its dimensions are, all we had to do was accurately measure the Great Pyramid, multiply by 43,200, and we get the key dimensions of our planet. Now, Egyptologists actually know this, but they say that it's entirely a coincidence that the Great Pyramid is a scale model of a hemisphere of the Earth on a scale of 1 to 43,200. And Egyptologists can't understand why 43,200 should be a significant number. What they need to do is to go into ancient mythology where that number and numbers related to it, multiples and divisors of it, all based upon the number 72, are universally distributed around the world. And there's been a detailed study of these numbers in myth by Professor Giorgio de Santillana, who was formerly professor of the history of science at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And what he suggests is what he calls some almost unbelievable ancestor civilization, which had grasped all of the scientific concepts that we work with today, encoded knowledge of a key astronomical phenomenon called the precession of the equinoxes, which unfolds at the rate of 1 degree every 72 years, encoded that knowledge in myths, and thus ensured that that knowledge would be passed down. All the storyteller had to do was tell the story true. He or she didn't have to know they were transmitting scientific information. They just had to pass down the story true, and the information was embedded in it, and a time would come when somebody would understand what that information was about. So the number 43,200 is generated by a key motion of the Earth itself, the wobble on the Earth's axis that causes the precession of the equinoxes, which unfolds at the rate of 1 degree every 72 years. So in summary, the Great Pyramid gives us the dimensions of our planet on a scale derived from a key motion of the planet itself. And that is incredibly clever thing to do.
Incredibly clever. And that's where your book gets creepy or scary, because it's not just the Earth. So the idea is, here's this advanced civilization currently not accepted by mainstream science. It has existed, I don't know how long. Do you have any idea how long this ancient civilization could have existed on Earth?
I have some thoughts. We can constrain it to a certain extent. There was an earlier global cataclysm, actually not caused by a cosmic impact. It was caused by the eruption of Mount Toba, oddly enough, in Indonesia. And this happened 70,000 years ago. It blanketed the Earth in a dense, poisonous cloud of volcanic dust, and it led to the near extinction of the human race. Genetic studies indicate that the entire human population of the Earth at that time was reduced to just 2,000 individuals,
wow,
from whom all of us today are the descendants. So any civilization that developed must have developed after 70,000 years ago. So I think we're looking at the time span between 70,000 years ago and 11,600 years ago when it came to an end. And that's plenty enough time to create an advanced civilization. One of the puzzles, actually, is we know that anatomically modern human beings with the anatomically modern human brain have been on the planet for at least 200,000 years.
Right.
Possibly much longer, actually, but we know for sure at least 200,000 years. And it's odd that we waited 195,000 years to form the first civilizations 5,000 years ago, since we had all the equipment to do it much earlier. I suggest we did do it much earlier.
Right. It would only make
sense. And I would put it in that window between 70,000 years ago and 11,800 years ago.
So here's this advanced civilization existing, and it's in part of what this advanced civilization does is they build these massive structures and encode within these structures messages that seem to be for another advanced civilization.
And message to the future.
Messages written, to the future.
In universal languages, the languages of astronomy.
It's very similar. It is, you know, we have, what is it, the Voyager probe that has the glyphs inside of it that show where the Earth is, that's drifting off into space right now.
Yeah.
It's as though these people have done the same thing through time.
Yeah, they've sent a probe through time, a probe that would survive for thousands and tens of thousands of years, and that we are witness to today. That's why the site of Göbekli Tepe in Turkey is so exciting, because it clearly is a time capsule, and it on its own, perhaps even more strongly than Gunung Padang, because you see, Göbekli Tepe in Turkey has been thoroughly excavated by mainstream archaeology, and what they've discovered there has blown their minds. Archaeology is still stumbling to catch up with the new evidence that comes out of Göbekli Tepe. Go ahead, Duncan. Sorry.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt. It's just the to me where your book is like it reminds me of a free fall ride at Six Flags, because it takes you really far up to this very terrifying height, and you think, whoa, this is incredible. There was an awful thing that happened on Earth, and these people were their lives were completely changed, and then. That's where, and sorry if this is a spoiler, guys, just read the book. We're just giving away the key bits here, but my God, it's great writing. But the scary thing is what seems to be a message in Göbekli Tepe. Did I say that right? Göbekli Tepe?
Göbekli Tepe.
Göbekli Tepe. There's a message there that seems to be written for us. Can you talk about what that message
is? It's targeted at our time.
At our time?
Very eerie thing. Well, first of all, Göbekli Tepe means pot-bellied hill in the Turkish language. And that pot-bellied hill is entirely artificial. Göbekli Tepe was deliberately buried by whichever mysterious ancient people made it. And that's why we can be absolutely certain of the dating of Göbekli Tepe, as we can in the case of Gunung Padang, because there's been no possibility of the introduction of later organic materials to the site, which might have caused carbon dates to give falsely young ages for the site. The site's been sealed for well over 10,000 years, and it's sealed because it was deliberately buried as a time capsule. That pot-bellied hill was put there by teams of men and women with buckets filled with earth and stones that they poured in over the enclosures containing the megalithic pillars, because Göbekli Tepe is a megalithic site, and completely covered them up and hid them away from view. And there they remained untouched until they were discovered in the second half of the 1990s by the German Archaeological Institute, when the excavation of the site began, producing evidence that literally in itself rewrites history. Can I share some of that problem with you?
Please.
Exactly what's going on with Göbekli Tepe. You see, megalithic sites, when we say megalithic sites, I suppose the world archetype of a megalithic site is Stonehenge. Göbekli Tepe, the area that's been excavated so far, is already the size of Stonehenge. But underneath the ground, revealed by ground-penetrating radar, is 50 times as much that hasn't been excavated
yet. Crazy.
There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of megalithic pillars weighing in the range between 20 and 50 tons that are still deeply buried, that have been pinpointed by ground-penetrating radar. And the next effort will be to excavate those and to find out what is there. So the site has still so much to reveal. But what's already clear, if the existing area is the size of Stonehenge and there's 50 times as much still under the ground, is this site is 50 times larger than Stonehenge.
Wow.
That makes it the biggest and the grandest megalithic site that's ever been created anywhere on Earth. And here's the problem. It's 7,000 years older than Stonehenge.
Wow.
Stonehenge has a background. This was a settled agricultural community in Britain at that time, generating surpluses that allowed specialists to focus on their particular trades, stonemasons, astronomers, and so on, and to apply those to the construction of Stonehenge. 11,600 years ago, our ancestors are supposed to have been simply nomadic hunter-gatherers with no surpluses and no opportunity to develop specialist skills. So it's extraordinary that a group of hunter-gatherers would wake up one morning equipped with all the knowledge and all the skills and all the organizational ability to create the biggest megalithic site that's ever been created on Earth without any background in creating megalithic sites. And not only that, but at exactly the same moment as 11,600 years ago, mysteriously agriculture suddenly pops up in Turkey. It's not been there before. It's just been hunter-gatherers. And then suddenly they're doing agriculture in a very sophisticated way. And archaeology is telling a kind of fairy tale about this, that you know, this was just invented. All of these skills were just invented overnight, that somehow people woke up equipped, magically equipped to create the largest megalithic site on Earth and to invent agriculture, when it's obvious, really, that what we're dealing with is a transfer of technology, that Göbekli Tepe only makes sense as a place where the survivors of a lost civilization who already knew how to make megaliths and who already knew everything about agriculture, they settled amongst the local hunter-gatherers and they initiated them into their system of knowledge. And I believe they used Göbekli Tepe as a kind of center of innovation from which new ideas could spread out. They were attempting to restart civilization. So what we see at Göbekli Tepe is not the beginning of civilization, but the starting again of civilization from an older origin that was destroyed in those cataclysmic events.
The
date of Göbekli Tepe is crucial. 11,600 years ago is the second spike of cataclysm, which occurred exactly 11,600 years ago. And it also coincides with the date that Plato gives for the destruction and submergence of Atlantis. He said that happened 9,000 years before the time of Solon. And Solon's visit to Egypt was in 600 BC. That's where he was told the story of Atlantis. So 9,600 BC is 11,600 years ago. And that's exactly the date that the latest science is saying we had a global cataclysm with massive flooding all around the world, the second spike of the Younger Dryas cataclysm. So, you know, the pieces are falling into place. And the whole story of the origins of civilization, as we've been taught it, is now up for grabs and up for questions. And we are poised at a moment of paradigm shift in the understanding of our past. And nobody ever said that a paradigm shift would be easy.
Right.
Proponents of the old model will fight tooth and nail. Many of them will live out their lives and go to their graves, refusing to believe that the old model has to be overthrown. But as time passes, as the new evidence keeps on coming in, as a new generation takes control, these ideas will become acceptable.
But these members of this advanced civilization that are educating hunter-gatherers in the art of construction and agriculture. What's really curious to me is they seem to have stretched out all around the planet, because you see, this is an amazing to me that you see again and again and again depictions of these beings with fish heads and like handbags.
Yeah, I call them man bags.
Man bags.
Like, same symbolism occurs all around the planet of these particular kind of bags. You see them on the earliest representation of Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent, who was the civilizing hero of ancient Mexico, the bringer of civilization in a time of cataclysm. You see a figure of the feathered serpent with the plumed head on the serpent, that is the classic image of Quetzalcoatl. Within the coils of the serpent sits a man man, and the man is holding this curious little bag. Exactly the same bag turns up in Mesopotamia, in ancient Sumer, in the hands of a figure called Oannes, in representations of Oannes, who was yet again a civilizing hero who comes in a time of disaster and cataclysm to spread the benefits of civilization. And the same bags occur on pillar 43 in enclosure D at Göbekli Tepe, right, where we know that they are absolutely 11,600 years old. And this is all around the world, this symbolism. And we were talking earlier about a message encoded at Göbekli Tepe, yes, passed down to the future and apparently rather spookily addressed to our time. Now, I would ask listeners to go read book and look at the solid evidence that backs this up, because what I'm going to say, isolated from the supportive evidence, you know, can sound a bit far-fetched, frankly. But there is a region of the sky which was actually of great interest to the ancient Maya. And that is the region of the sky. The Milky Way is our galaxy, and we view our galaxy edge on when we look at the Milky Way. And in the center of the galaxy is an area called the Dark Rift. It's made up of nebulae, and it looks like a dark gap in the center of the Milky Way. And for many ancient cultures, the Maya in particular, this was seen as the womb of creation. Huh. And indeed, that's odd, because out of that black hole at the center of the Milky Way, there is a black hole at the center of the Milky Way, yeah, out of that poured all of our reality. It's curious that they see it as the womb of creation. Wow. And the womb of cosmic rebirth, this is how it was seen in the Mayan system of things. Now, on either side of the Milky Way at this point stand two constellations. One is the constellation of Sagittarius, and the other is the constellation of Scorpio. And this is what is depicted on pillar 43 at Göbekli Tepe, is the constellation that we call Sagittarius on one side, constellation that we call Scorpio on the other, and sitting in the middle, exactly over the dark rift of the Milky Way, is the sun. And that's the crucial timer. That tells us what sky is being represented, right, here. Because it's only in our epoch, on the winter solstice, the moment of rebirth when the old year dies and the new year is born, the moment that was focused on in the Mayan calendar, it's only on the winter solstice in our epoch that the sun sits astride the dark rift at the center of the Milky Way between the constellations of Sagittarius and Scorpio.
Okay.
So it appears that whoever created that pillar, and again, I have to refer listeners to the book for the backup,
yes,
to this, whoever created that pillar was able to calculate the precessional changes in the sky over thousands and thousands and thousands of years. Just as we can do with modern computers, we can simulate ancient or future skies very accurately. This was being done by some ancient culture who passed down their knowledge to the Maya, and it's encoded in the Mayan calendar. And exactly the same information is encoded on pillar 43 in enclosure D at Göbekli Tepe. And it's a picture of our sky today, 11,600 years later than Göbekli Tepe, 11,600 years in the future from when Göbekli Tepe was made, when the sun on the winter solstice sits aside the dark rift between the constellations of Sagittarius and Scorpio. Now, this, of course, connects further to the whole drama of the Mayan calendar. You know, just when we thought it was safe to get back in the water, after all the fuss and noise about the Mayan calendar and the suggestions that the world would come to an end on the 21st of December 2012, yes, here is evidence that's asking us to look at this again. And the evidence, we need to take account of work of great scholars like, for example, John Major Jenkins, who for years was telling us that the Mayan calendar was not predicting the end of the world on the 21st of December 2012, but was rather predicting a time of great turmoil and change in a window of time, not a precise moment, but a window that extends roughly from 1960 to 2040, because it's in that window, and only in that window, that the sun sits exactly astride the dark rift at the center of the Milky Way on the winter solstice between the constellations of Sagittarius and Scorpio. And it's that, it's the processional apparent motion of the sun. Of course, it's caused by a motion of the earth, the changing orientation of the earth in space. The earth is the viewing platform from which we observe the heavenly bodies, so it changes their placement peaked in the sky over long periods of time. And the sun on the winter solstice, because of the precession of the Earth's axis, has been appearing to move steadily on a steady arrow-like path towards conjunction with the center of the galaxy. And that conjunction isn't just on the 21st of December 2012, that's roughly the midpoint, but it is a window between 1960 and 2040. And it's that window in time that is encapsulated and depicted on Pillar 43 at Göbekli Tepe. And this seems to me, in context of all the other evidence that Göbekli Tepe is a time capsule, very much like a message. And that message is, look at the sky in your time, pay attention to the sky. And that's why we also need to listen to what astronomers are saying about the remnants of that same giant comet that caused so much devastation on the Earth between 12,800 and 11,600 years ago.
Right. And that's scary. That's where it gets scary.
That's where it gets scary. But I want to emphasize, it doesn't have to get gloom and doom. We don't have to throw up our hands and say the end of the world is nigh. That's not what's involved here. There's hope in this, a great deal of hope. We already have all the technology we need. We possess it already. It's fully developed to make our cosmic environment safe. The problem is that our governments presently are not interested in that. Our governments presently are interested in spending billions or trillions of dollars on military expenditure so that we can all slaughter one another in very sophisticated ways.
But let me stop you there for a second. The conspiracy theorist in me wonders, do they already know that this is an event that is about to happen? Mm. Or are there people who are aware of this? And that's one thing I wonder. The other thing I wonder is, what happened to this ancient civilization that you call the Watchers? Mm-hmm. What happened to them? Did they just vanish? Are there remnants of them? Are there other streams of information that aren't just encoded on massive structures? Is it possible that some disciplic lineage has maintained itself through all this time period? Forgive me, I'm sorry, I'm a pot-smoking hippie conspiracy theorist, but this stuff makes me think, is it possible that they're still around in some form?
It is possible. This was a system of initiation that sought deliberately to preserve and pass down knowledge. And I think it's come down through many different streams to the present world. And those streams have been interrupted and diluted many times. And maybe the line of transmission is not as clear as it might be. But I'm quite sure that it has been passed down, that there are people who are aware of this information. And I do think that there are people in NASA who are aware of this information. And that's a disturbing thought, given that NASA is actually doing very little about our cosmic environment at the moment. I mean, to give you a figure, it's roughly the cost of running one McDonald's for a year is what is presently being spent by NASA on protecting the Earth from cosmic impacts. Whereas billions and trillions of dollars are spent on warfare and on other NASA programs, which are often vanity projects for particular individuals.
Why don't they want us to know? Why would this information?
NASA's always been against cataclysms. It also buys into the kind of uniformitarian dogma that has enshrouded geology for so long. There's a real reaction against cataclysms, and NASA is NASA doesn't the. What it appears to be is they're afraid that if they talk honestly about this, it will result in fear and panic spreading and perhaps a breakdown of social order. And they're, of course, heavily invested with other government agencies in the maintenance of social order. But you couldn't have a bigger breakdown of social order than allowing another major cosmic impact to occur.
Right.
Look, to cut a long story short, Duncan, the torrid meteor stream, which the Earth passes through twice a year, and which we've just been through, as a matter of fact. The torrid meteor stream is 30 million kilometers wide. It takes the Earth 12 days to pass through it on each passage. We passed through it at the end of June, 12 days at the end of June, beginning of July, and we passed through it at the beginning of November, 12 days at the beginning of November. Both occasions we see meteorites, which are objects in the torrid meteor stream that enter the atmosphere of the Earth. We actually don't see them in June because they come in from the sun side of the Earth. They're there, but we don't see them. But we do see them in November. People often call them the Halloween fireworks. The evidence is in now. The torrid meteor stream is the remnant of that giant comet that hit the Earth 12,800 years ago. Further fragments hit the Earth 11,600 years ago. The most definite, certain recent bombardment from that meteor stream was as recent as 1908, and that's called the Tunguska incident,
right,
when an object out of the meteor stream entered the Earth's atmosphere and blew up in the air over, fortunately, an uninhabited area of Siberia. That object was only about 100 meters wide, but it flattened 80 million trees, and it devastated an area bigger than the city of London. If that had happened over a major center of population, over a city, hundreds of thousands of people would have been killed, and we would all be very, very concerned about the torrid meteor stream today. And I cite the work of astronomers who are at variance with NASA, who are deeply concerned about the torrid meteor stream, who feel that the comet's business with us is not yet done. There are large bits of that comet still orbiting in the torrid meteor stream. Remember, it's 30 million kilometers wide. So there are filaments of very harmless stuff in it, just dust and little rocks. But then there are filaments of very big pieces, and the calculations indicate 100 pieces of at least a kilometer in diameter, one piece of 30 kilometers in diameter, are whizzing around on this orbit that the Earth crosses twice a year. And minor variations in the Earth's orbit put us into different bits of the torrid meteor stream on each passage. And it's just luck, blind luck, that we haven't been hit very much yet. The last impact was in 1908, with the big impact before that, way back in the 12,000 year ago period. But it's like crossing a six-lane highway with a blindfold on.
Wow.
And just hoping that we don't encounter any traffic. That's what it's like. And the calculations of the astronomers, Victor Klube, Bill Napier, the late Fred Hoyle, and the mathematician Emilio Spedicato, the calculations are that we are likely, because of variations in the Earth's orbit, to be crossing a particularly hazardous area of the torrid meteor stream repeatedly in the next 30 years. And we should be paying attention to the sky of our time, just as that pillar from Göbekli Tepe tells us. And we do have the technology to make our cosmic environment safe. It's simply a matter of choice. And for some reason, we're not making that choice. Does somebody actually want a cataclysm to occur? Is that possible? Could that be the case?
That's the terrible question.
Yeah.
That's it.
An avoidable cataclysm. That's also the infuriating thing about this. It doesn't have to happen.
Well, is the theory some kind of depopulation? Is the idea
maybe
press reset?
We know that there are individuals who like that idea. And this would certainly be a way to bring about an instant tragic depopulation of the Earth.
But it seems ridiculous that anyone would want that to happen who planned to live on
the surface. Unless they prepared for it to ensure that they survive.
But survive
that,
what?
That they dominate the new order.
But then it's, if these cataclysms cause such massive climate change.
Yeah,
then
it would be a very foolish thing to do. But who's to say that those who rule us are not fools, are not actually clinically insane? I mean, if we look at the behavior of our ruling powers, they appear to be mad. They start wars all over the place. They constantly create instability. They tell us they're making us safer by building up military expenditure, when in fact they're making us much less safe. You know, how do you make yourself safer? By annoying everybody. You make yourself safer by being friends with everybody. That's how you make yourself safe. Your friends don't kill you. It's only your enemies who kill you. So the best way to make ourselves safe is not to go around the world making enemies, I would say. You know, it comes down to the old thing. Basically, if the human race operates towards one another with love, rather than with hatred and fear and suspicion, we can solve any problem.
Right. Right. And that's the great absurdity of our time period, isn't it? Here we are about to cross this cosmic interstate blindfolded, and the armies of the Earth are fighting each other for imaginary reasons, when there's a very real threat looming on the horizon. And It's got to be frustrating for you to have seen this stuff with your own eyes and to know that this information, for whatever reason, whether out of some intentional conspiracy or just out of people being stuck in an old mindset, this very important information is being kept from the majority of the world when it seems like this is the time period where everyone should be aware of it.
Absolutely. Well, that's why I've written this book. First of all, to show that our understanding of the origins of civilization now has to be radically revised, that we are indeed missing a very important part of our story. And I'm presenting the detailed evidence for that. And anybody can follow up my sources and check where I get my information from. I believe in being completely transparent in setting out my sources, and they're all there in the book. And secondly, as a kind of wake-up call to humanity, this is a time when we need a grand human project that all of the human race, all of us, brothers and sisters all around the world, would have to cooperate on against truly a common enemy, which is the enemy of a cataclysmic destruction of everything we hold dear by a space rock, you know, and yet we have the capacity to prevent it. This is not something that we just have to throw up our hands in helplessness and say, bring it on. We can prevent it if we want to. And so it is sinister that people may know about this and yet are not taking the steps to prevent it. Very, very disturbing
situation. It's like a test, isn't it? It feels like if a civilization is to advance to some certain level, it has to pass a test. And that test is, it has to figure out a way to join together to create the technology necessary for a civilization to continue to exist in a universe where planets naturally get slammed by interstellar rocks. And if we can't solve that riddle, we're done.
Yeah. I mean, in my view, it's until we solve that immediate cosmic problem, you're really wasting our time exploring deep space. We need to secure life on Earth first, and then we can get on with exploring deep space. But while life on Earth is jeopardized by these cosmic bolides, these huge impactors that are spinning around out there, you know, the estimate is that NASA has so far only identified 1% of potentially hazardous asteroids or comets, and that 99% are out there but simply unidentified, that we're talking about hundreds of thousands of objects that are dangerous to the Earth. And it's just crazy that we're not paying attention to this. And this is, you know, this is why my book, I don't dwell upon this at great length in the book. I go into it in some detail in the last chapter only.
Right.
But this book is not only about the past, it's about the future. And, you know, our understanding of the past, which has been held in the death grip of a particular group of specialists called archaeologists for far too long, our understanding of the past shapes our present and shapes the future that we make. And that's why it's important that we know the truth about our past, and that it's part of the mind control system on our planet, actually, is to keep the past from us, to tell a comforting story about the past in which we see ourselves as the apex and pinnacle of the human story, when in fact we're just a restarting of the story of civilization, when in fact a great civilization was so fragile that it was wiped out 12,000 years or so ago. And what's to say that we will not be the next lost civilization? It's interesting to look actually at Plato's story of Atlantis, and what he says there is that Atlantis at one time was a beautiful and spiritual culture filled with love and nurture of all things beneficial to the growth of the soul, but that as time passed it became cruel and arrogant, pumped up with pride, overconfident in its own abilities. It began to extend its power around the world. And in a ringing phrase, it ceased to wear its prosperity with moderation. And this is our civilization today.
Yes, it is.
We've become cruel and unkind, and we have ceased to bear our prosperity with moderation. We're so proud of our technological achievements, and we think that's what it's all about. And the mythological evidence suggests that such a civilization, pumped up with arrogance and pride, is actually in a very dangerous situation. And if we knew that a former civilization had been lost in a global cataclysm, if that was, you know, something that everybody understood, I think we'd look at the character of our civilization much more carefully than we're presently doing.
That's right. And that this brings us to a point, you obviously feel free to say no to this. I don't mean to put you on the spot. I was wondering if we could close the show with you maybe reading this very short poem, which I'm sure you're aware of, Ozymandias.
Ozymandias. I know the poem, Ozymandias, King of Kings, but I don't have it in front of me, Duncan.
You do now. Check your Skype.
Okay. Let me see. How do I check my Skype? I'm not a very technological man.
It should be in your chat window.
My chat window. I don't know how to find my chat window.
Shall I email it to you?
We should have prepared this.
I should have done it in the beginning. Well, I forgot.
I see something here. Oh, yes. Yes. Wait a moment. There it is.
I can cut all of this out, too.
Okay. I can read this.
Great.
Thank you, Duncan, for sending this to me.
Thank you so much for doing this podcast. Thank you for this beautiful book. I so enjoyed reading it.
And it's Shelley, isn't it?
That's right.
I met a traveler from an antique land who said, "Two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read, which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal these words appear: My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare. The lone and level strands stretch far away."
Thank you so much for reading that. And thank you so much for being a guest on the show.
It's a poetry. I've actually seen the sculpture that poem is about.
I didn't know it was based on a real sculpture.
It is. It's based on the fallen sculpture of Ramesses II, which you find in the Ramesseum on the west bank of the Nile at Luxor. And it is a truly stunning sight, actually. And that cold sneer of command indeed is visible.
Wow. Well, I hope everybody who listened to this will order Graham's book. You've heard the basics of the thing, but the pictures and just, I had such a great time reading this, and I actually did, you know, I did fact check a lot of the things you said, just because some of them just seem so impossible. But then when you find that takes you, each of those little facts will take you down rabbit holes for hours on the internet, and it becomes increasingly awe-inspiring when you realize just how accurate this book is and how this information is brand new and something most of us were never taught. So thanks for writing it, and thanks for being a guest on the show. And
well, thanks, Duncan. And if people want more information, my website's the obvious place to go. I guess you'll put up a link when you put the show up. But the website is grahamhancock.com, and there's a page dedicated, a whole lot of material dedicated to Magicians of the Gods there. So go have a look at that and other material. There's a lot of backup right there on the website.
I'll have all the links in the comments section of this interview. And definitely check out Magicians of the Gods. And thank you so much for being a guest on the show, Graham.
Thanks for having me on the show again, Duncan. Lovely, lovely to talk to you.
Nice chatting with you.